You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe 10-year anniversary live streaming event. Joining me in our newly refurbished Skeptolair today are my partner in crime, Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
My other brother, Bob.
Hey, everybody.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
So, this has been 10 years in the making. As you saw in our intro video, we've been doing a lot of things over the last 10 years, but primarily the SGU podcast, and it has been quite a ride, and we are here today to celebrate everything SGU. So, guys, I mean, 10 years, what do you, over 500 episodes.
Did it feel like 10 years? It didn't feel like 10 years to me, personally, which is a good sign, I think.
You think so?
I've got it went much faster than it seems. Absolutely.
I've got 5 years left of me, then I'm out.
Really, Bob?
You're in here first.
I mean, I feel like we all worked a lot during the past 10 years, but we enjoyed the work. That's why it went by really fast. I have to mention, we started the podcast with Perry. Rebecca Watson joined us along the way, for 9 years, and we had, you know, just an incredible time working with Rebecca. And now on to new things. I am going to start this show by saying to you guys, why don't we actually right now discuss making a 5-year commitment at the very least, 5 more years at SGU.
Jay, I'm in this indefinitely. I have no horizon. You know what I mean? I'll do this.
But I want to make a commitment. So, Evan,
will you do
5 more years at SGU?
5 more years, you got me.
Bob, will you definitely do 5
barring,
more years?
Barring what scenario do you think?
If you're breathing, will you do the show?
What if we get a TV show that won't leave us time for this? Would we bail
nice.
On the podcast?
Or we'll do this or something better.
Okay, all right. I could commit to that.
So, qualify.
We are being joined by George Hrabe, our first guest for our 10-hour show.
Gentlemen, 10 years.
George.
My gosh. That's all I got. We're almost done, right? We're almost done, right?
Yeah.
How long have you been doing it, George?
What, two minutes now so far? Oh, the 8 years, yeah,
so
8 years.
Your podcast, Geologic Podcast.
Yes, Geologic Podcast is 8 years, so it's nowhere near as old as you.
No, you're almost exactly 100 episodes behind.
Yeah. Just about, yeah, every time you guys have, like, I have something which I think is very exciting, and then, like, a week later, you guys are like, no, we have 100 more. It's like, yeah, that's fine. 200, 300, 300, 400.
All right, let's do a news item. We're seeing the back of a young man. Oof. Do you guys, what do you think is going on in this
it
picture?
It looks like liver mortis.
Looks like
he's alive, however.
He was beaten.
Well, it's definitely not road
It looks
rash.
Like he was beaten, doesn't it?
Looks like he was beaten. Yeah.
I'm gonna...
Is it one of those like cupping massage things, like the, where they make a little vacuum on your back using like little suction cups?
Yeah, it's something like that, but that's not what it is.
Is it bruising from like poor nutrition?
It's abrasive therapy.
It's slapping therapy.
Oh, even better.
Oh, God.
That's a thing.
That's a thing.
So somebody, this guy paid for someone to slap in his back.
It gets much worse than that. So this is called Peta. This is part of traditional Chinese medicine.
Is it ancient?
Who knows? I mean, they just rewrite it, whatever.
God, it looks terrible.
Ancient Chinese.
This was done by a gentleman by the name of Hongqi Zhao. Slapping therapy, part of traditional Chinese medicine. So he was giving seminars. He was charging $1,800 for a 7-day workshop where he taught you how to slap yourself and beat yourself.
How do you slap yourself?
To what
back?
End?
You must use something. To what end? Of course.
To what end?
The purpose is to activate your chi.
Oh,
right? So you hit yourself.
That's how you do
and
it.
That sort of gets your chi moving. You're also slapping the toxins out of your skin.
Oh, of course.
Now it makes sense.
I masturbate the toxins out of myself.
is that right?
Successfully?
Yeah, it works
the
every
chi.
Day.
Yeah, the chi. I have lots of
twice
chi
on Sunday.
All the time.
Yeah. You cheat all over.
Right, so it's
called cheat 'em.
Honey, there's chi in the sink and there's chi all over.
Got a little bit of chi there.
There's chi all over your chi. The thing is, if you're expelling toxins out of you, it should feel good after you do it. There's, you know, like, these people are doing this.
They feel horrible.
Yeah.
They feel horrible, but that's part of the healing crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So if anything, this is like one of those, it's good, it's a heads I win, tails I win kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, like on Full Metal Jacket, anyone who moves is a VC.
Yeah, right?
Anyone who doesn't move is a well-disciplined VC. So if you feel good after the treatment, that's because the treatment's working.
Right.
And if you feel bad after the treatment, that's because the treatment's working. That's your healing crisis. That's the toxins
hey,
coming
that's
out falsifying. Of you.
Now pay me.
So now pay me $1,800. But it gets worse than that.
Oh,
So, Aiden Fenton of Sydney, Australia, a seven-year-old boy with type 1 diabetes. His parents thought it would be a good idea to take him to this clinic for slapping therapy. Now, it's not clear if he was actually treating his diabetes during the therapy or not, but in the middle of this therapy, it was like you go to a resort hotel and like you're at the hotel and you're getting the therapy during the day. His parents found him in his room dead. The kid died.
What? From what?
We don't know.
But he was at this retreat.
He was in the middle of getting this therapy. So
slapped to death.
He was slapped to death. So, he may not have been taking his insulin. He may, who knows if he was getting the right nutrition during this amount of time. He felt like crap, but that's the healing crisis. So he ignored signs of he wasn't doing well. He was so sick, he literally died. And, under the ministrations of this TCM quack. I mean, can you imagine?
Seven-year-old.
That's child abuse.
Yeah,
completely.
Even if he didn't die,
completely.
It's child abuse.
Why is there such a pain? I mean, this is like reminds me of the flagellation.
Yeah, that's right. Self-flagellation.
They do self-flagellation. It's a Christian thing, a Catholic thing. Yeah. And then there's the Muslims that cut their heads with.
That's right. They bleed.
And there's this weird pain. Being a celebratory
purifying,
yeah, like purifying through pain.
Well, I guess it's part of penance or sacrifice type thing. I don't know.
Who's the first guy to sell that? That's it's a good thing. Maybe it served some purpose initially it's like a miserable existence, but it's good and you'll get through it and you'll be okay.
But it's sad to think that you have to teach people the idea that we've evolved over millions of years that pain is bad.
Right.
Pain's there to tell you something's wrong or whatever, but, if you're doing something to heal yourself and it's painful, that's probably a bad sign.
Yeah, but the thing is, with modern medicine, right, we tell people all the time, it's going to hurt a little bit, but you got to get the injection or the procedure's unpleasant.
Pain, no gain, right?
Well, there are times when especially children, we have to convince them that there's some discomfort, some unpleasantness, sometimes even pain associated with a procedure or a diagnostic test or whatever, but it's for the good. So people are kind of already sort of used to that logic. Yeah. And now here you have a healer telling these people this is going to hurt, but it's worth it. It's going to cure him his diabetes. And so the logic is the same. It's just that this is nonsense. This is magical nonsense.
The more it hurts, the more it's working.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I know when I was doing hardcore CrossFit stuff, a day or two later, you're sore and it hurts. But I would think, yeah.
It feels good.
Get up out of the chair like that. And Kira all the time be like, you okay? Like, no, it's good. It's good. It's good.
It's good. It's good pain. Yeah.
And it got to be this joke of I would just always be saying it's good because, my mind is this represents the effort I made 2 days ago in working out, running or whatever the heck it was.
I like that sort of sore feeling.
No, absolutely. But this is an extension of it in terms
of... But that's unpleasant. This gives
absolutely.
Miserable. Oh, this
yeah,
is, but yeah. also, this there's a little bit of evidence to say that exercise is beneficial and slapping is not, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's actual evidence. Here's just a quick thing. If you see these little dots, you see this?
Show this camera.
We are infested...
With ladybugs
all over this house.
Well, it's not just this house, Bob. Most people in this part of the country have ladybugs.
Yes, we're in Connecticut. Every spring, we get an infestation of ladybugs.
Better those than stink bugs, because we have stink bugs.
Yeah, they're cute.
Ladybugs eat other bugs.
Yes, okay. So why are ladybugs not considered gross?
They're not pests.
They're
adorable.
They're actually beneficial for...
Is it because of their coloring? And then is it true that the number of dots represent how old they are?
No.
That's a myth. Bob and I were talking about
it. They are adorable. Right. I mean, how many adorable insects are there? Butterflies and ladybugs. Yeah. Right? Yeah. What else?
Well, some caterpillars are pretty. The hairy ones are pretty.
Yeah, I guess so. Well,
I mean, I've seen buckets of ladybugs. Like gardeners will sell them sometimes.
Yeah, because they're good for your garden.
And it's like even a bucket of them is like... cute.
Yeah.
What other bug can you have a bucket of bugs?
They're basically cockroaches. Yeah. I mean, but why are we repelled by cockroaches?
It's
that adorable.
It doesn't have antennae and tentacles and all sorts
segmented.
Of weird things protruding.
It's round.
It looks like a Volkswagen car. It's got round edges and everything.
And they don't bite. Right? They don't bite
hard. They taste pretty good.
If they bit, we would be killing that right now.
Yeah, you're right.
But then when they die... Then there's hundreds of dead ladybugs in my house.
They're very bad at clearing their dead away.
Yeah.
They're very irresponsible about that.
Everything's better than a dung beetle.
Taste wise or that?
Yeah, I just wouldn't want one rolling a giant turd around my kitchen, right?
Guys, I have a discussion topic for you.
Okay.
It's the topic I call black box tech.
Oh boy.
So the idea is that as any particular technology advances, the accessibility of that technology to the average person gets less and less and less until eventually it converges on just a black box.
Right.
Where we have no idea like what's going on. Like, for example.
Like this.
Well, this is
something in magic out.
Yes. Let's start with cars, right?
Uh-huh. Yes. Good
50
example.
Years ago, I'm led to understand that it was not uncommon for just an average person to to tinker with his own car on the weekend or whatever. And, you know, I personally knew people growing up who, always had a car, halfway built in their driveway.
Right,
you know
that's
what I mean?
Right, up on they blocks.
Could, yeah, they could take the engine apart, put it back together. They worked on their own car, you know. But as car technology has progressed, that's getting less and less. I'm not saying there's nobody out there who could do that. But, you know, right now, if you really want to be able to work on a new car, you need fancy equipment and computer diagnostics, and you just can't tinker with your
it's
own
all
car.
Bearings, yeah.
Yeah. It's just, it's almost, and like to me, as somebody, I'm not a mechanic or anything, but you know, I sort of have an average person's working knowledge of what the carburetor is, the oil goes in there and whatever. But now it's, you know.
It's chips, it's computer chips.
I know, it's, well, a lot it of, is. Yeah. But well, even I have no computer. Idea what's going
but
on.
But if you pop the hood on a new car, a lot of times you can't even see the engine anymore. You have to take things out just to get to the point where you're starting to see the top of the engine.
The Japanese engines, they've turned them sideways, fit. Like I have a new Honda Fit that I got. And you open the trunk, the front, the hood, and the engine's crammed into the space like this.
Yeah. And it's on a big shock absorber. You ever start the engine, you see the whole engine?
Oh, yeah. I was speaking to a guy just the other day who used to maintain his own car, do everything in it. I mean, he's 65 years old, but he can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
He said it's impossible. He doesn't have the equipment. He doesn't have the hookups for the computers. And you go to buy, the screwdriver set to undo some of these things. They'll make special screwdrivers that only fit certain, models of cars or brands of cars and stuff. And you have to spend $1,000 for a screwdriver set to fit that specific brand of car. So they've made it sort of, inaccessible.
It's all proprietary.
Is it because secondary markets now are another source of income for these companies? So they know that you have to take your car to a licensed dealer who's going to fix it, or the licensed garage is going to deal it, and they get a piece of that action? Or is it because the technology just gets more and more efficient and more better, better designed. Much more better designed. Or is it both? Which is driving it? Is it the money's driving it? Probably the money's driving it.
I think it's probably just the technology's driving it. I just think, I think that's the low energy state, right? If the technologies are evolving like that, it would take work and collaboration to keep every company from having their own proprietary tool set. And they don't care enough not to do that because maybe there is some secondary gain. So why make the effort just to gimp themselves, possible source of income?
The thing, TV, for example. There is a TV repair shop in Bethlehem.
Yeah.
Who's going?
It's
a typewriter and TV repair shop.
The typewriter.
And I'm like, it's been open since I was in college back in 93. Yeah. And I'm like, how is this place?
TVs are another good example.
Yeah, TV's a perfect example where you just I think they just want you to throw it out and get it
on. Oh, yeah, we definitely, the disposable economy without, so this topic came up because I had built my own computer and I bought, George, you and I had this experience when we were editing the happy video for last year's TAM and my computer just went
jout.
Yeah, and that was
This is going great!
It just totally just shut off, right? So I went through the basic checklist. I'm like, okay, maybe the fans weren't working properly and the motherboard got too hot and it's supposed to shut itself off.
Right.
And I have been debugging that for a year.
Yeah.
I've replaced every component.
Twice.
A couple of times over.
Is it the same
Something's
computer
going
then?
On. Now, I mean, I've built a handful of computers in my life. I get every component. I understand how motherboards work. I understand a lot of things about this. Nothing is strange to me. But there is some type of monster in that machine and I can't figure out what's shutting my computer down. So I tell Steve, I'm like, I don't know, man. I'm just wasting time now and my time is worth more than the cost of this computer at this point. I think, Steve's like, well, just bring it to a local shop. I'm like, I don't even think they exist anymore. I looked up some local shops.
Yeah. Really?
Then how do I know they know what they're doing?
Right.
Right.
That's the other thing. I'm gonna hand them a $2,000 computer that was a rig built for video editing with four hard drives in it.
And lots of porn probably, right?
Well, don't even get me started. But what do you think that was on a hard drive? But the idea is I don't even feel safe about doing that. I don't feel comfortable handing over my PC to a company like that.
So computers are a good example because, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I would routinely crack open my computers, upgrade them. You know what I mean? It was, and I
switch out boards.
Switch out boards. Pretty much my
testation. Yeah, we got the bug.
And that's just getting less and less, you know, common and likely. And so you end up with something like an iPad, right? No one's cracking open their iPad. I mean, I'm sure there are. I'm sure now you're at the really rarefied hacker level before you're cracking open an iPad. I would never dream of cracking open a device like that. Or even just like your average laptop. I've never upgraded a laptop. Yeah. Some people do, but
you can swap a hard drive.
Maybe even swap a hard drive. Desktops,
battery.
I still would. But even desktops, we have the desktops running our console are these tiny little things. Like that, George, that's our desktop.
Yeah.
It's like these mini, why would you bother going in there? Yeah. I mean, so it's literally a black box. It's literally,
a black box.
Why would you crack it open? So where's it going to be in 10 years? So you can see it goes from the average user being able to tinker to only the exceptional user to you really need to be like a licensed repairman to throw it away and get a new one. I mean, the engineers at the company know how it works and that's about it.
How about in the future, you give the black box to your advanced computer and the robot will take it apart. Like, here you go. It's all set here.
It might get to the point where it's not even humans anymore who are the only ones who are able to really understand the tech, but.
To the point where humans can't understand it at all.
They won't need to because these things will repair themselves. I read an article recently about how Audi Corporation is experimenting with technology in which a car gets in a little fender bender herself. They want the car to be able to fix itself.
Oh, like Christine.
Yeah. Well, not exactly, but yes.
Without the demon though, yeah.
Also change color. You can have a red car one day and a blue car the next day.
But I think it's part of the arc of things that are going to happen here, whereas technology becomes more nuanced, smaller, more powerful, the average user won't be able to be a part of fixing things and everything. However, you know, now with 3D printing, I think we're going to start seeing people making their own stuff, being able to do things that we've never done before. Like maybe you could download lots of schematics for 3D printing and you can then start to combine things. Another cool thing that's happening, Google is building a modularized phone where, you have like a piece of plastic that you would be bolting on. You know, here's my battery space. Here's the type of camera I want my phone to have. Here's the, different components that you want. And then you replace them as they get old or whatever. But, you're right, Steve. We're not going to be fixing our auto-driving, self-driving cars.
Right.
And tinkering with that kind of stuff.
Does this lead to the big civilization crash?
Next question is, if you forget about individual technologies on this arc. Are we on this broader meta arc, culturally, technologically, where people are getting more and more and more narrow in their expertise? We have less and less working knowledge of the everyday items around us, and we're going to get to the point that we're immersed in a technology that nobody really understands. We're just users, and we're completely dependent on the technology. And if the lights ever go out, we don't know anything. We have no practical skills, because I know how to, I often have considered how effective would I be if I were thrown into medieval Europe or completely non-technological space as a physician?
Can you make sandwiches?
I would be the sandwich maker.
The first thing that popped into my head is, how am I going to brush my teeth?
Yeah, but think about it. I'm a physician. I'm a trained physician. Yeah, I have decades of expertise. Could I even function? I can't order an MRI scan. I can't order lab work. I could do an exam. Yeah, but there's something you have to almost be trained.
Set a bone if you had to.
I've never done it. I've put shoulders back into sockets though.
Oh, you could deliver a baby.
Could deliver a baby. I've delivered my own baby. Delivered my second child.
Yeah, but you could do all that stuff. I don't know if I have any skills.
But 99% of my knowledge would be instantly worthless.
It gets even more basic than that. Think about food. 100 years, 150 years ago, you grew your own food, folks. I mean, you went to the farmer's market and you traded for other food. Today, if you had to, most people had to rely on making their own food to live, forget it.
That's interesting too, Ev. I wonder, I don't know the stats on this, but, you know, the whole like locally grown thing, you know, a lot of, with modern shipping, you know, we're getting apples from South America here in the United States, you know, and all that stuff. Like, there might not even be, like, farms around us like there used to be. There probably isn't.
There already isn't.
There's housing in all
Connecticut,
that space.
Connecticut used to be mostly farmland, and now it's mostly not.
But even if those farms are then automated by, you know, a machine which waters and picks and processes the stuff, and then that generation dies out that knew how to pick and process. I mean, we'll get to the point where our progeny won't know how to boil water, won't understand what's involved. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, but
what's the line then?
Yeah, but you're talking about technology advancing, but there's other components to that technological advancement. Say, for example, intelligence augmentation. Sure, at some point we'll become super specialized and you might understand this in a sea of technology that you won't understand. But if there are things like intelligence augmentation, then you could potentially understand a vast majority of that kind of stuff, right?
Like Neo and say like, okay, building a fire.
I know Kung Fu.
I know how to deliver a baby.
We are far away from that.
Interesting.
We are far away from that.
Of course, but
that is something that I think will happen eventually.
But if that processor, which is driving that Kung Fu download thing into your brain, breaks down, you know, because there's an asteroid hits the planet or something. You know what I mean? Like, If the source for that energy, which is driving the machinery, which is letting us be able to download whatever we need to know to be able to make pancakes, like, if that's out, you were screwed. Already the planet's screwed. Already, if there's some major, let's say a huge solar flare were to happen, and were to burn out the power grid, which is totally possible.
Sure, it's happening now. Like, if my wife isn't home, there are no pancakes.
How do you know?
I'm already living in the kitchen crying. But I mean,
Stone Age.
One big solar event wipes out the grid. Yeah. And how long would it take to get back to where we are today? Would it take five years, a decade? Would it take
this is how much collateral damage in the meantime?
It's even worse. I'll give you, I must have said this many times because it is a scary idea. There's proprietary information all mixed in throughout humanity. So as an example, there are companies that have a process that they do something and that company is one of a few that has a process to do that thing. And that company passes along its knowledge to its employees,
Coca-Cola.
Right? So if we go, the recipe is gone forever.
Very important.
No, they're important things.
Sure.
You know, things like, when they build a transformer, you know, there's not that many factories that build these gigantic transformers and we were talking about if the grid went down, it could take a decade for us to get those factories back up in line. But there are people that if they're gone, the knowledge is gone.
Yeah.
Like,
there's institutional knowledge.
That's it.
There's institutional knowledge, there's cultural knowledge. So like even in medicine, right? I mean, most of the really important knowledge is not in textbooks. It's in the experts. And if you lose them, you lose their expertise. Mm. You can't reconstruct it from reading the textbooks. You know, you can get maybe halfway there, but you can't really get the expertise.
This is why we really do need to, and this is probably never going to happen or whatever, but it would be awesome if we were able to put all human knowledge into artificial intelligence of some kind to stitch it all together and preserve it. You know, someday.
Beyond the internet.
But you think like Walking Dead level societal collapse, they're screwed. I mean, it's gone.
Yeah.
It is interesting how long would it take. I often thought about that because they do have a leg up because they do have a lot of the knowledge is there in books and stuff, you know, so they're not starting from scratch. They don't have to necessarily reinvent everything. But given, you know, you're thrown into, you know, a society, let's say they achieve some kind of political stability, you know, security, whatever. Everything's good. And now they're in their reconstruction phase. They have to rebuild society and they have what they have. You know, a dramatically reduced population. Some people even may be born after the collapse and have no pre-collapse knowledge. How quickly could they get back to where we were just on the remnants of knowledge that's out there?
I'm sure it would be quicker, but there would be things.
Would it take 100 years, 1,000 years?
There would probably be things that would never be the same level
centuries.
Like, you know, like the particle, you know, physics, for example, right? You know, Like, we know people that have these skill sets.
Or like theoretical physics.
Theoretical physicists, right?
Yeah.
Like, how long would it take?
We could survive without theoretical physics. I mean, that's like.
That's, yeah.
It's too bad. It's too bad we didn't have
someone.
It's
an embellishment. Invest their time and effort into studying that when there's so many more courses.
Something practical.
Something practically actually matters in life.
You know,
it's much better.
So boring too.
It's completely.
I mean, what's the point?
Useless.
Completely.
If someone were in the room that could answer some of these questions for me, it might be useful.
Mm-hmm.
Like Brian Weck.
What?
The
Brian Weck.
What?
Wait a minute.
How long would it take? So Walking Dead happens.
Yeah.
Now they get rid of the zombies and they're actually rebuilding humanity. And now they start cracking open books and whatever. Maybe they get some computers running or whatever. But there's nobody that has your level of knowledge alive anymore. It's just regular people. How long would it take to get
that? So they're starting from essentially zero?
Just books. Just books and maybe some computers that were left over and stuff like
libraries.
That.
Remnants.
Stuff.
Yeah, I mean,
no experts. The experts are all dead. Now they're trying to rebuild that expertise from what was left behind.
There's a couple, well, there are lots of great textbooks, of course. To get up to the really latest stuff, that probably would take a long time because, for example, the LHC is collecting data and you'd have to build another LHC.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Assuming that the zombies ate the current one.
They ate it?
Yeah. They live in it now. They're walking around 27-mile tunnel.
But the fact is that there wouldn't be anyone like you to teach the next generation, right? So they have to read things that would be inherently super complicated that they wouldn't understand.
And one thing that I think that makes that even more problematic now, so you guys know the archive, right?
Yep.
Which is a preprint server where just pretty much all the papers in particle physics come out these days. So when I write a paper, actually the first place I put it is not in a journal, but it's on this preprint server where every morning, if you're a particle physicist, you look at it and then there you see your papers for the day and you say, oh, that one looks interesting, that one doesn't.
You laugh at a lot of them, sure.
Yeah, it's, there's no peer review on the archive. So you can, in principle, people are very, very careful about it, because that's what everyone reads. It's your whole career at stake. But, there's no peer review and things can be wrong.
Sure.
And that's why I think we have sort of a problem in some sense. Overall, the system works. The papers on it, I think, are generally right, and the field works great. But let's say a paper is discovered to be wrong, as happens all the time. It's science, right? You put something out, and then something comes up later, and people say, oh, yeah, there was a mistake in that. There's no real effective way just on the archive of, unless people are going to withdraw their paper, which people generally don't do. Even when it's sort of widely known that the paper is wrong, there's no real effective way, aside from this oral tradition of, hey, don't read that paper because, I know that's wrong for this kind of complicated and subtle reason. There's no way that information has been preserved.
So then if they found that, there's a slew of misinformation or old information that they would be like, think is right, and then, It could take, wouldn't you say, 100 years of picking up the pieces to get back
probably
to where we
not
are today?
Far from just based on textbooks. Let's say, I think you can do pretty well. Let's say you could learn quantum mechanics really well, right? And quantum mechanics was pretty well established, by the 30s or so. To get to the current level, probably about 100.
Think about how much misinformation is in print.
Right.
And not in your archive, but in other archives. If some civilization was going to start building, be
right.
Like, oh.
Let me give you an example from medicine. So what I consider to be a crank is somebody who has access to, on PubMed now or whatever, access to the medical literature, can sort of read it and make some kind of sense of it. Maybe they even have like some kind of background, but they can't really put it into perspective. So they think they're being science-based and evidence-based, but they're hopelessly lost in the weeds because they just have they weren't taught clinical judgment, how to really, what's meaningful and what isn't meaningful. And so they come out with this elaborate crank nonsense. So in essence, everyone would basically be a crank, because they're just, they would get lost in the weeds of what information they could find, but they don't have anybody to teach them, like, how to make real sense of it.
Yeah, and I find the more I've done physics, right, way I think about physics, the way I approach problems is more, when you get down to it, you're doing the calculations, but the initial kind of guess about what might work and what might not is based on, at this point for me, 20 years of intuition, which is not really transmittable in any easy fashion. Hmm. It's just from working with people who have been in the field for a long time and then
that's what
I pass that on to students. That's exactly what
Do you think there would be ages like Stone Age, Bronze Age, like sped up.
Yeah.
But that you would have, if civilization were to fall apart.
I think there would be different ages. I don't think it would recapitulate what's already happened because there would be this hybrid because, you know what I mean? Because we have some knowledge already there.
Yeah.
Like, I think like knowledge of how to smelt iron and make steel, that would probably be pretty easily
Schmelting.
It'd be reconstituted just from reading the technical menu.
Right.
You know, like, so
it could be like, you know, 6 months.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
Like
but,
a, you know, Iron Age for whatever, 6 months. And then, or like, yeah.
And then last month.
But we may not even have an Iron Age. It may just be, they may go right to
Platinum Age.
Or would it just be this, like a weird recycling?
Yeah.
Like no one would smelt anymore.
Yeah.
But you would just be able to recycle.
The scavenging age.
The scavenging age. Yeah, scavenging age.
It'd be different ages. Yeah, it'd be interesting.
I gotta go, boys.
You did.
George.
So much fun. Congratulations on 10.
Thank you so much. Thanks for coming and joining us.
You too, George. See
you soon. Thanks a lot, guys. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks for coming. Good seeing you.
Thanks, guys. Enjoy the, what, 7 hours?
10 total.
Yeah.
We're 3 hours.
6 hours, 57 minutes. We have our counter on the board. 6 hours, 57 minutes left.
Cool. Have fun. Thanks so much, Brad.
Thanks a lot.
All right, Brad.
So we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, Future Advisor. Bob, do you think you have enough money to retire?
I know I don't. I'm really concerned about it.
Well, you don't need to be concerned with Future Advisor, Bob, because they're going to help you make sure that you do have enough money to retire, or at least reach whatever financial goals you're looking to achieve. And they don't have hidden broker fees. They have a really good strategy, and their financial software is going to ensure that you're going to get the most out of your investments, Bob, and that's what's going to be able to help you retire sooner. These folks have been featured. You've seen them at lots of different places. Fortune Magazine, Wall Street Journal, and their software is really, really efficient. With Future Advisor, you just plug in your investments and they'll take it from there. The whole thing takes about 2 minutes.
Yeah, one of the things I like about it is that you can make the changes yourself, or if you don't want to, you can let Future Advisor manage your portfolio for a fraction of what your advisor would charge you.
So if you have any type of retirement account, you can go to futureadvisor.com/SGU and get a free portfolio analysis. They'll give you a report about your money and a plan for the future in under 2 minutes free. Just go to futureadvisor.com/SGU. All right, guys, let's get back to our show. So, Bob, you wanted to talk about the new Tesla battery. Tesla is promoting a home battery that could be, a game changer for the market. I'm guessing it's a little premature for that, but tell us what you think.
Well, yeah, this recently came out, just a couple days ago. There was a press conference.
I'm quietly going up the stairs.
Thank you, George.
See you, George.
I'm quietly going up the stairs.
Did you hear something?
Yeah.
So, billionaire Tesla Motors CEO Elon Musk recently announced, and he has hinted at this for months now. People have been speculating about this. He's talking about the unveiling of the first battery designed for the home, which is only really a subset of what he's really talking about. But it's getting a lot of the press. It's called the Powerwall, and I loved his quote at the press conference. He said, "The issue with existing batteries is that they suck. They're really horrible. They're expensive, they're unreliable, they're sort of stinky, ugly, bad in every way." So if you look at the image of the Tesla Powerwall batteries, they're definitely not stinky and ugly. They're pretty cool looking. So what is this thing? What is he talking about? What is this image representing? So what you see here is the Powerwall, which is a big lithium ion battery, which is pretty much derived from his Tesla cars, right? I mean, it's essentially very similar to that. These, what you're looking at here, each individual unit is about 4 feet by 3 feet, and it's very thin. I forget that last dimension. Is it like 12 inches? It really is not going to be sticking out from the wall too much.
Like a flat screen television.
Yeah.
So not even as thick.
So the power wall comes in two types. You've got the 10 kilowatt hour battery and the 7 kilowatt hour battery. They're $3,500 and $3,000 U.S. dollars. So they're fairly cheap for what you're getting here. And the claim is that they can be used to power most homes during peak evening hours. So that's pretty interesting. So the benefits that they are claiming now is there's three major benefits that they claim. One is load shifting, where you could actually charge during low rate periods and use them during the the peak hours, which is interesting.
Save you money.
Yep. There's also the claim for solar power storage, which is kind of big because, photovoltaics really improving by leaps and bounds. People are putting it on their roofs.
By which you mean they're making slow incremental improvements every year.
Yes.
But adding up to, I think we are getting to, not to get off topic, but we are getting to a bit of a tipping point where solar, panels are actually economic. They're cost effective. And so.
I agree. And if you look at where we were 10 years ago compared to now, all those slow incremental changes have added up to something extraordinary even now, and just going to get even more so. And also, for solar power storage, that's another big benefit. And then there's also backup power for outages. So that's the other big thing that they're touting for this power wall. Yeah. So, I tried to come up with a bottom line. All right. What's the bottom line of the power wall? How good is it really? What are we talking about? And I've got some interesting information from Dan Steingart, who is an assistant professor in mechanical and aerospace engineering at Princeton University. He seems like a guy that I would trust, generally speaking, about this thing. He lives battery technology like this. So his assessment was that this would be great for an uninterruptible power supply, but it's not quite there yet for your everyday electricity usage. And so if you want some hard numbers, he says that on a per kilowatt basis installed, the cost of energy is roughly 4 to 8 times a standard generator. So you could go out and buy a standard generator for much less than what these guys are costing now. And of course, depending on hours of usage. He says, in rough numbers, at this cost, you either need a 10 times the cycle life to compete with a generator setup at full utilization. So these are 10-year batteries. So he's saying that you would need an order of magnitude more than that to make this equivalent to a standard generator. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And he says that in order to compete with utility pricing of electricity, you would need 10 times the cycle life at 1/3 the cost. So to compare
not
with
there
it.
Yet.
But so, is that because they're not being mass produced? Is that a huge factor in this?
Well, sure. When it's mass produced, the price will go down, but not by what we need to make it equivalent. Not yet. It could take a while. Remember, his figures here do not include installation cost and the cost of an inverter. I mean, inverters can be very, very expensive. So he's not even counting those things. So he's saying if you know somebody who knows how to install it and save you some money, that would be great.
What kind of life do you get out of these things?
How many years? 10 years. They're saying 10 years,
but obviously they haven't been used for 10 years, so we don't know. The other thing is with batteries like this, and it's for anyone who like uses an iPad or whatever, the battery life might be great when you first get them. Your phone, like Bob, you complain a lot. But the battery life, it's not like you get 10 years out of it, and then they stop working.
100%
they are diminishing in capacity the whole time.
I've had my iPhone 6 Plus since November, and I'm seeing a battery hit now.
Although it's
now.
Hard to say, though, because with phones, the more you load apps on there, the apps drain a lot of the battery use. So there's a lot of other variables in there than the battery itself. But even still,
that's true.
But we know that the batteries lose capacity. Right. Their capacity tends to goes away. Wanes over time. Absolutely. The as your backup solution, it's not cost effective. Get a generator, right? I mean, that's much more cost effective at this point in time. Although it would serve that function if you had one. I think the main reason to get it is to store
renewable
energy like wind or solar that you're getting during when it's available.
Daytime, and, bright out,
or windy or whatever, and. But, not necessarily meeting peak use, right? So this is a way of buffering production to use. But of course, for now, you could just use the grid for that. You can just give the electricity to the grid and take it off the grid when you need it. So you don't really need this until we get to the point where we're producing so much electricity that the grid can't take it.
That's a really good point. I would talk to Joe, our brother Joe, about this. He has a lot to say about this. And he would totally agree with that right now the grid is essentially a big battery. So you don't really need this for the grid if there is no net metering, though. If there's net metering in your state, which is an important concept, where basically you sell the surplus energy that you create to the utility. If you don't have that, then this makes sense. It also makes sense for this if you're not on the grid. Obviously, if you're not on the grid, this will come in handy. Mm-hmm. And it also could be good for, as an uninterruptible power supply. But otherwise, right now, it doesn't make a lot of sense, depending on how the solar works in your state and things like that. But now, if we step back a bit and get an even bigger picture, this is actually the Powerwall is part of a new brand for Tesla. It's called Tesla Energy. And incorporated into this new brand of Tesla Energy, we also have things that are more optimized for business and utilities, not just the Powerwall. So the Powerwall, you could stack these. You could see right here in that image that there's three of these tied together. You could stack 9 of these together and you would get 90 kilowatt hours, from 9 of these stacked together. Mm-hmm. But if you take a step up, you get what's called a power pack. Now the power pack, that's meant for much bigger installations, for big businesses, for utilities. Yeah. And these, check this out, these are infinitely scalable. You can put these power packs together, these 100 kilowatt hour power packs, and scale them together. You can go to 500 kilowatts, you can go to 10 megawatts, or even at gigawatt levels. You could put enough of these together to power an entire city.
How about 1.21 gigawatts?
Right.
That's where it
imagine off. Powering an entire city if you had a gigawatt level of these things.
That's what Fairbanks, Alaska does right now. They have the largest battery bank, I think, in the world, and in their winter times, they need to have that in order to survive.
This would be great for them.
Here's two numbers
he threw out. If you had 160 million of these power pack units, that would be enough for the United States. 2 billion could power the world, which would be what, 200 terawatts. So,
all right, but it's not just, like we said though, it's not just the creation of the power packs. It's having the other hardware that you need to make it work.
Well, these integrate very seamlessly into pre-existing solar installations and the grid. They're designed to pretty much plug and play.
All right, so
that's a big point for these guys.
The problem is that these batteries don't last forever. Okay. So you have to include in any kind of calculation about the environmental impact, the efficiency, the cost effectiveness. How much does the battery cost? How long will it last? How will the capacity change over time? What do you do with it when it's, when it's spent?
Yeah. So the environmental impact, that's big. What are we going to do with the
unless
billion
Tesla
of these
has a means
batteries?
Of taking it back and reusing the parts and everything and building
new batteries. Yeah, if they recycle it would be nice. But apparently, it's complicated. I mean, there's no big market for recycled lithium. So I don't know what that means. You could interpret that as, well, it's cheaper just to pull mine new lithium. But there's other toxic chemicals in there as well, and I think there's some rare earths, and they're actually hard to extract. We actually send our electronics to China to extract the rare earths because they don't have laws protecting the workers from all the horrible toxins.
Oh my God,
that's the problem. There's less rare earths in a piece of electronics, concentration wise, than there is in the raw mineral, that we're extracting it from. So, in any way, environmentally, it's complicated. That's why, using all electric vehicles, unless you count the cost of producing the battery, disposing of the battery, all that stuff.
It may not be worth it.
Yeah, you have to include that into calculation. Sure, it seems to me, I think this, we're in the early adopter stage where this is not universally useful, but there may be some niches where it is useful, and that will drive the technology and get us maybe over the threshold where it'll become just another appliance you have in your home, at some point. Yeah.
Your home battery.
So this is just the very, very beginning.
But the other way to think about this is incorporating batteries into the grid.
Yeah.
Now one way to incorporate them into the grid is for lots of homes to have them.
I agree.
Right? Because the homes then become the buffer. The another way is just for the utility companies to have the mega, arrays of batteries to buffer their own grid.
Yeah, the battery stations.
Now there's a couple of advantages for having this kind of a large amount of battery capacity in the grid. One is that it helps load balancing. So if the utility company has to balance how much electricity is going through wires at any point in time, and if they don't load balance properly, that's how you could have overload.
Yeah,
brownouts or whatever.
Yeah. Another thing is you want to flatten out production. So in the morning and the early evening are the peak use of energy of electricity, and then there's troughs when everyone's asleep and in the middle of the day. You have to build your infrastructure to meet peak demand. And then that peak capacity goes unused off peak.
Right. Okay.
That's hugely inefficient. So imagine if we could if we had enough batteries in the system that they were buffering the energy, that the production and demand could be flat. We could just produce how much energy people are using on average just 24/7. And when we're overproducing, it gets stored, and when we're underproducing, we pull it out.
Okay, yeah.
So I think eventually we'll want a grid that where we have that built in. But lithium-ion batteries may not be the answer, right? There's other ways to store energy that we're working on that people, you know, and we may, especially if we start to go more and more over to renewable energies like wind and solar that aren't on demand, you know. We want to, there's another point, this is kind of a subtle point where another, there's another advantage here is that when we have to, like go to that peak capacity, we go to more and more dirty forms of energy, right? So like, we're actually burning more coal at some times than in other times.
Yeah.
So, right, does that make sense? So if we, if we could lower our peak capacity, because we don't need it, because we're
because we have all the batteries.
We could get rid of some of the dirtiest forms of energy,
right,
the most expensive or whatever. So there's that advantage as well. It wouldn't necessarily equally decrease every form of energy. We could preferentially get rid of the dirty coal.
But I see it as kind of a catch-22, though, because right now, in the future, with a battery like this in every home, that would be a great thing, to, like you said, to buffer the energy or the power. But in the short term, this probably doesn't make a lot of sense for, you know, for integrating it with your solar in states that are, you know, that don't have the net metering. So, but there are other good ideas. So it's kind of a catch-22. It doesn't make sense to use it now in certain applications, but in the future it will once it's ubiquitous.
Right. All right. Let's change gears a little bit. Jay, I want to hit one of your news items.
Sure.
You're going to tell us, you're going to give us a bit of an update on the patent troll, the podcasting patent troll.
Yeah, we've talked about this on the show before, and I think part of it was we were a little worried because this company, this U.S. company in Texas called Personal Audio LLC, had been suing a lot of big corporations that have podcasts or, you know, that type of, you know, they're sharing this media, they're distributing this type of media in a particular way. So this company, Personal Audio LLC, has in fact sued companies like NBC, Fox, Apple, and then they sued Adam Carolla's company.
Because he's got one of the most popular podcasts going.
What we're saying about this company, to pull it out right away, is that these guys, I consider them to be called a patent troll. We've talked about patent trolls before. So a patent troll can be thought of a company that either buys a bunch of patents or they apply for patents specifically to sue other companies. And so their whole company's basis is to gain money through lawsuits, which I think is beyond despicable. So now let's dig into Personal Audio LLC a little bit. So this company started with their filing of patents on October 2nd in 1996. And I'll take a look. I'll read like the one sentence description of these patents. An audio program and message distribution system in which a host system organizes and transmits program segments to client subscriber locations. That's one of their patents. Another one, an audio program and message distribution system in which a host system organizes and transmits program segments to client subscriber locations. Let that sink in for a second. They're essentially saying, you know, you can't distribute media. You can't do that. That we own that idea. And the whole idea, the whole idea of a company owning these basic ideas, really the core of this whole item, which we'll get into the details more about Personal Audio, but as we describe this to you, you know, think about just the idea of companies owning things that in my opinion should not be patentable. You should not be able to say nobody else but us can do it unless you pay for it.
It's, you're not supposed to be able to patent an idea that's obvious.
Yeah.
And I think that they need to more generously interpret what that means. You know, distributing media on an intermittent basis. What, really? That's a patentable idea? That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That's absurd. This is one of the worst patent trolls I've ever heard about. John Oliver did a great show. We talked about John Oliver before. Did you see his patent troll?
No, I didn't see it.
It's awesome.
It's awesome.
It's incredible.
He gives a lot of really ridiculous examples. Like some company got sued because they were Xeroxing something and then faxing it from their office, and
so that's
somebody had the patent on doing that. I mean, it was like ridiculous.
Oh, come on. Oh, yeah.
It was ridiculous.
Yeah, but Randy once brought up, he said somebody patented not the peanut butter sandwich itself, but the making of the peanut butter sandwich.
Yeah.
The process of making the peanut butter sandwich.
Sandwich. That's
some kind of, yes, a sandwich.
Mark Cuban from Shark Tank, there was one episode. I like Mark Cuban. He's pretty cool. Pretty skeptical dude. This guy came on and he had clothing that had wiring in it.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, they always ask, do you have any patents? Because patents have.
That's it.
Yeah, they're huge in that game. You know, the ownership of the intellectual property can make or break a company.
Right. So no one could swoop in and take away your idea and totally dilute your contribution.
But I'll never forget, this guy's on, he's pitching his business. He's like, yeah, and I've patented, like, you know, wiring something from, like, you know, this part to the, and Mark Cuban lit into that, laid into this guy. He's like, you know, it's guys like you that are stopping innovation and keeping other companies from coming up with good technology. And he really got pissed. I'm telling you, this guy's whole thing went from, like, wow, pretty cool. Like, he's got this cool, like, multi-device vest thing. And after Mark said that, I'm like, that guy's an asshole. Mm-hmm. Like, he turned me around.
He's trying to patent the idea of putting a wire through a shirt.
Yeah. Get out of here. Okay, so you sew a wire into a shirt, and now you're the only person that can do that?
What's even worse is that patent trolls sometimes try to patent the use of a technology that doesn't even exist yet, right? And then once, like, 5 years down the road, 6 years down the road, like, it's a thing that's about to be, somebody's about to engineer the thing, and they say, okay, good, when they get to that point, I'm going to patent the idea of using that to do this thing over here.
Yeah.
And then they, just so they could sue everybody then who tries to use that technology in that specific way. Again, it's
abusing the system.
Patents are the whole idea behind patents is that they're supposed to protect creativity so that spawns innovation, right? It's supposed to promote, and I know that that's controversial and there are people who think that there should be no patents, but whatever. If you accept the basic idea of patents, the whole point is to protect, you know, intellectual property, so to encourage innovation. But patent trolling does the opposite. It discourages innovation. Mm-hmm. These people aren't even really producing anything. No. They're just scavenging for ideas that no one's patented yet and then trying to squat on it so that anybody who uses this obvious idea has to pay them
money.
And
try to sue them. Yeah.
And then not only that, it's defending a patent suit can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Oh, yeah. You won't get anywhere with your product.
It's cost effective. Just pay the VIG. Just pay the $50,000 or whatever. So it's blackmail. It's just
how the mafia works.
It's corporate blackmail.
I was thinking when I was reading, you know, reading all of this stuff to get ready to talk about this again, you know, and I'm getting angry all over again.
It doesn't make you angry. It's like, this is broken. It's so broken.
It's like
please
this.
Fix it.
So in 2013, let's get to the Adam Carolla bit. Personal Audio filed a patent infringement lawsuit against Lhotse Digital Inc. And this company produces the Adam Carolla Show and the other podcasts on the Carolla Digital Network. The lawsuit stated that Carolla and his company infringed on one of the personal audio's patents, 8112504. Adam refused to settle. Yep. And you guys remember when this was going on. Like he got so livid, he became an expert on this stuff, you know, fully educated himself. He's a smart guy, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
And very, very funny dude. So he raised $475,000 through crowdfunding, which I think is awesome because his audience helped him pay for this. His listeners totally backed him. So on July 29th, 2014, Personal Audio dropped the lawsuit stating that the defendants, ready, were not making significant money from infringing on Personal Audio's patents. So they basically said, now this could be their bullshit cover for dropping it, but they basically said, you know what?
You're not worth
Never mind. It's not worth it. After $475,000 worth of a lawsuit took place. So Adam was so pissed that he countersued. He asked in the lawsuit, one of the things that he asked for in his lawsuit was that Personal Audio's patents be completely invalidated. And that was awesome.
Yes.
It was ballsy and it was really awesome. So the whole mess ended in August 15th, 2014, when Carolla and Personal Audio settled out of court, which I think, you know, sometimes it's fine for a lawsuit.
That was his suit against them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's fine if lawsuits get settled out of court. There's a lot of circumstance. Steve and I have learned a lot about this over the past year for our personal experiences, but there's lots of reasons why these things happen. But the good news, because of Adam's lawsuit, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, you guys know who the Electronic Frontier...
Give it the quickie.
So they're, They're a leading nonprofit organization defending civil liberties in the digital world. They were founded in 1990, and EFF champions user privacy, free expression, and innovation through impact litigation, policy analysis, and grassroots activism. This is an awesome organization. They do an enormous amount of good. Go to their website and just read up on the different things that they're doing, and they have a quite a dossier of things that they've achieved and everything. And it's a nonprofit. You know, this is not being done for any other reason other than to be the good guys. So on April 10th, 2014, the Electronic Frontier Foundation petitioned for a review of personal audio's main patents. They raised $76,000 to do this through crowdfunding again. And in the petition, they said that personal audio should never have been given ownership rights to a way to create an updatable electronic table of contents. That's really at the core of their patent. That's what they were saying. The EFF challenged the patent on the basis of two of the following arguments. Here we go. The suggested technique would have been obvious to other developers, like Steve said, at the time, meaning it should not have been protected. The evidence given for this was that CNN had described a web-based video library of its own in 1995. Huh. So CNN publicly described technology that Personal Audio patented later on. So CNN actually originated, because they didn't have their patent, but they had the original idea, and you could trace it back to them.
So the troll didn't even have their own idea. They went and borrowed CNN's idea from years prior.
Or it was so obvious
that many people came up with it.
Yeah, it was just like, even if they didn't get it directly from CNN, the point is this idea was out there. It was obvious. It's not something that should ever have been patentable.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the other point they brought up was the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation published a paper in 1996 detailing its trial of a system that allowed people to download radio shows from the web following their broadcast.
There you go.
This meant the technique had already been anticipated, like Steve said, in a printed publication before the patent was filed, meaning related rights should never have been granted. So they effectively proved that the patent was completely bullshit because other companies had already come up with this stuff. So, guys, after reviewing the patents, the U.S. Patent Office invalidated critical parts of the patent that was given to Personal Audio. Adam Carolla's settlement was for $0, by the way. He didn't pay anything. So, the good news is, in this particular situation against Personal Audio, the good guys won. They got the patents invalidated, and Personal Audio officially is something that podcasters don't have to worry about anymore.
But the bad news is that it's still too easy to patent obvious ideas. What's being done about
that?
Yeah, why did that happen?
It doesn't solve that problem.
And what can we do about that?
That's the reform. I'll tell you, that's exactly. Yeah. We need patent reform. Here's the problem. The fact that there's millions of lawsuits going on, the courts are behind schedule by years because there's too many lawsuits going on. There's too many patents being filed. And there's not enough intelligent people to sit down, not enough physical.
They're just getting rubber stamped.
Yeah, there's not enough man hours to actually go through this stuff. This is why, this is going to sound crazy, but I think we need artificial intelligence to go in and really examine all this stuff and figure out what's what. Hmm. But, it's just one of those things. As more and more companies, humanity grows, more and more companies exist, more and more patents are happening, technology is snowballing, like, how do you keep up with it? Big companies like Apple and Samsung are suing each other left and right over technologies that you stole this, no, you stole that, and it's like constant litigation going on with all these corporations. Very interesting read, though, guys.
Yeah. It is, yeah. Well, everyone, we're going to take a break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors, The Great Courses. We've been watching their series, 12 Essential Scientific Concepts by Professor Indre Viscontis, who we've actually had on the show before. She provides a really great foundation for basic principles of science. It's really a great course to introduce you to a lot of different concepts like thermodynamics, brain plasticity. I can tell you she handles the neuroscience really well, magnetic fields, and lots of other topics. It's a lot of fun.
We don't want you to take our word for it. Check it out for yourself. They offer engaging audio and video lectures from top professors in over 500 topics, including science, history, math, art, and music. You can watch or listen to these courses with online downloads, streaming via their apps, or on DVDs or CDs, whatever they are.
And right now, there's a special limited time offer for our listeners. Order from 8 of The Great Courses' best-selling series, including 12 Essential Scientific Concepts, at up to 80% off the original price. But the 80% savings is only available for a limited time, so you have to hurry.
Yeah, so go to thegreatcourses.com/skeptics. That's thegreatcourses.com/skeptics. All right, guys, let's get back to our show.
All right,
All right.
We have our next interview coming up. Hi, Julia.
Hey.
How are you?
Who? Happy 10-year anniversary.
Thank you.
I made you guys something.
You didn't
I made you a present.
Yes.
Yeah. I looked up online what the gift was for a 10-year anniversary, and it was tin or aluminum.
No, no.
Did you know that?
I knew it, but I forgot it.
It's not my best work, but I made you this tinfoil hat to celebrate and also to protect my brain from alien spying.
Wow.
Excellent. Fashionable and practical. That's great.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll send it to you after you can, the
yeah, feel
show's
free
over.
To send that to Bob.
Yes.
he needs it most, right?
Of course.
Promise me that you'll wear that for this entire interview, though.
Oh, yeah.
Why would I not?
What a fashion statement.
So, Julia, you are a fellow skeptical podcaster, rationally speaking. How many years are you into with your podcast now?
It's almost exactly 5 years. We just celebrated our 5-year anniversary at Nexus. So we are exactly half as old as you.
Well, this year,
which is kind of cool.
Yes.
yeah, this year. We do it bi-weekly, and we've taken a few summer breaks, which I suppose reflects our more sort of academic attitude, that we feel like we deserve summer hiatuses.
Academic,
yeah, you guys are workhorses. And I don't know if maybe some of your audience already knows this, but Massimo and I have been co-hosts from the start. We co-founded the podcast together, and as of this month, Massimo has decided to officially retire and move on to bigger and better projects, I imagine.
Yeah, I heard that he's too cool for podcasting.
Yeah, that's right. Podcasting is...
That's what he thinks. Maybe the rest of us got cooler.
He didn't see the tinfoil hat.
He couldn't keep up.
Maybe he would have stuck around if he saw the tinfoil
hat. Yeah, he left a little bit.
Maybe he just shot his wad, you know.
That was it.
There's nothing left to talk about.
Nothing else to say.
He has said it all.
I doubt...
I forgot how colorful this podcast is. We try to keep things classy.
Whoa!
No shooting of wads over at RS. It's just me for now, and our intrepid producer Benny Pollack.
Benny's
records and edits every episode.
Since you bring up changing your mind.
As I often do.
Yeah, we were chatting about that a little bit at Nexus, and I thought it would be a good topic of discussion. What's interesting is that, and this, I think we've had this experience too, is that we certainly acknowledge that it's necessary to be open to changing one's mind. And I think we all feel that we would be perfectly willing to change our mind if confronted with a better argument or better evidence on any particular point. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, great. Tell me something about which you've changed your mind. And I've sort of had that challenge put at me as well. And of course, nothing comes to mind when you get asked that question. Because I think that, well, you tell me about it. So what are your thoughts on changing one's mind? Why is it so hard to think of examples of it happening? And does that mean we're hypocrites or something else?
So I originally thought it's because we're hypocrites. That was my original hypothesis. Because, as you said, I kept having this experience of talking to, you know, leaders of the skeptic movement, proponents of rationality and critical thinking who would wax rhapsodic about how important it was to change your mind, and how we should all be changing our minds all the time, and it's not shameful, it's admirable. And then I would ask for an example, and they would go, and so originally I thought, yeah, we're all talking the talk and we're not walking the walk. And then I started noticing that after that moment, when people failed to produce an example of changing their mind, literally sometimes 10 or 15 minutes later in the conversation, they would just organically bring up something that their views had shifted on. I had this experience with Randy recently. He was one of our more recent guests. He again was talking about how everyone should change their mind and how it's important for the scientific mindset. And I asked for an example and he said, I can't really think of one. And then 10 minutes later, he ended up talking about, well, I guess Massimo brought up the blog post that Randy wrote about, global warming. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in that post, Randy had said, yeah, you know, it's not really clear to me either way. And after so much backlash, Randy sort of acknowledged, yeah, well, maybe the consensus is stronger than I realized. Maybe I have more of a leadership role, and therefore more sort of moral responsibility to investigate the consensus before I post about my ignorance than I realized. And he even shifted his opinion in discussion with us in that podcast episode when I brought up an example of an analogy to the vaccine autism, the alleged vaccine autism connection, that if someone in Randy's position had said, well, I just don't know if there's a connection between vaccines and autism, you know, it's just, I don't know, I'm not taking a position, that people would rightly say, hey, you know, the evidence is clear, and if you claim that it's not clear to you, then that's actually taking a position, you know. And Randy agreed. So that I think that was a great example of him sort of changing his mind on the spot, despite having been unable to produce examples.
Oh, you caught him in the act of shifting his position.
Yeah, yeah, it was great, actually, and I really do think it's wonderful, and, like,
right.
Told him so at the time. And so I think part of what's going on with our inability to call up examples on the spot is that mind-changing is usually not a very discrete event, right? Usually there's this sort of, just like, this is so meta, I'm sorry, you guys, I always do this, but my example of how I used to think that people were hypocrites, and then gradually I started noticing examples where, in fact, they did have examples of changing their mind, they just didn't realize it when asked. Yeah. That was a gradual process where I just had to sort of, I had to be on the lookout for examples that contradicted my assumption, and eventually I started to notice them, those examples right, accumulate, right. And I sort of stepped back and was like, wait a minute. But that was gradual, and so I think there's not, it's not like a boom moment that gets seared into your brain, like, February 10th, 1992 was the day that I changed my mind about
right.
whatever. So it's sort of harder to do that search query and come up with examples because they're not tagged as such.
Yeah, because I guess it's the assumption about, like, how do you define changing your mind? Yeah. And I think people think of it as, well, I was way over here and then I had to make a massive shift and alter my way of thinking in a completely different direction. But that is not how we function. Psychologists have demonstrated this, you know, for decades, that essentially we follow a Bayesian approach, right? And a Bayesian approach is we have a certain belief system about whatever, any fact, anything, and we gradually update it when new information becomes available. Mm-hmm. Of course, if you're emotionally invested, you resist that process. You sort of get anchored.
There's some friction
That's the motivated reasoning. You sort of anchor yourself to the position. But if you're not highly emotionally invested in the outcome, we just happily update our beliefs and our thinking and our knowledge about things as new information comes in. And it is a step-by-step gradual process. What we don't do is take one piece of information and then shift all the way over to that. We just gradually move in that direction. It's one, not, you know, we add it to our existing beliefs and body of knowledge. So there's this slow shifting. And when I realize, like, if you've changed your mind about anything, if you think about it in a broad sense, it's like, yeah, every day. Every time I read a news item, I'm changing my mind about something. I never thought that the universe was expanding. Now I believe it is expanding. I changed my mind on that because new evidence came into play.
True.
It's not like I believed it wasn't expanding. I just didn't believe it was expanding, if that makes sense. Or medical treatments. I mean, every day I'm reading new studies and I'm altering, you know, what I think works or doesn't work. I used to do lots of things that I don't do anymore in medicine. So that's, each one of those is changing my mind about a treatment because, you know, a study was done and showed that the preliminary evidence showing maybe it works. Now we have evidence showing it doesn't work. Okay, I changed my practice based upon that new evidence.
Part of the problem here, I think, is when somebody asks us that question, our go-to knee-jerk reaction is, you think of skepticism. And of course, ESP, Bigfoot, UFOs, we're not going to change our mind about any of that because we know it's all bullshit.
But well, we could.
We could give a scenario about how we could change our mind, but we haven't.
Yeah.
Ever since I've been an activist, we haven't. So I haven't changed our mind about anything.
Because we're dealing with issues that are easy in a way. So
there's something fundamental about, say, homeopathy where we know it's wrong. And the amount of evidence that we'd have to be given and the amount of change that would have to take place or, you know, something brand new coming up that no one's ever thought of. But as an example, like I've been reading quite a bit about the riots that happened recently, right, in the United States.
Baltimore, you mean?
Yeah, the Baltimore riots. And, you know, when I first saw the news, you know, without getting too deep into any politics, I had a very strong belief about, you know, I was like, okay, I don't want to say.
Your initial reaction.
I had my initial emotional reaction. Then, you know, I'm on Facebook, I'm looking at news, and I'm reading, I read a couple of news items, and I'm like, oh, I didn't think about that. I felt like a big shift and where I was going with it. And then I found that I had gone to about 4 or 5 different positions. It's not even like I'm, you know, it's not black or white. There was all these nuances of different positions that I'm starting to read. And until now, I'm kind of settling into what I think my assessment is. But it's evolved on a daily basis since it happened.
Mm-hmm. Right. Evolving might be a word that better describes what happens and indeed what should happen. And makes it sort of, I forget if I was telling you this, Steve, but I think that this confusion over, or this implication of changing your mind as being discrete and sudden, is not only leading people to have a hard time calling up examples of having changed their mind, but I think it also prevents them sometimes from evolving mm-hmm. their mind the way that they should. My theory is that when people encounter a new argument or evidence that challenges one of their worldviews, and they think that their options are either I have to agree that this evidence is correct and I have to instantly change my mind about this deeply held worldview, or I have to find a reason why this evidence is somehow flawed so that I can reject it and not change mm-hmm. my mind. And when it's binary like that, it seems so absurd to have to relinquish an entire worldview because of one piece of evidence that if you feel like you don't have the option of sort of shifting, gradually evolving your beliefs, then honestly, the more sensible option really is to reject new evidence and arguments. Mm-hmm. And I think it's only when the availability of that third way, that gradual evolution, is made salient to you that you're able to do that.
You know, yeah, slowly evolving your opinion based upon evidence and ideas is what we do, and it's actually the way to go. But also suspending belief, suspending judgment, meaning saying, like, there are topics that come up, it's like, yeah, I'm going to assume that I don't know enough about this to really have a firm opinion. Mm-hmm. I just feel like I don't know enough about this. So I'm going to not have a strong opinion about this mm-hmm. until I learn more. That's legitimate. I mean, it's a cop-out if you're using that to evade taking an opinion on something you very well, like, have enough information about. But legitimately, like I'll give you an example. And again, this comes up a lot practically week to week for this show. Like, for example, I remember we would occasionally get questions about recycling. And I had to make a decision whether or not to talk about recycling on the show. And for like 2 years, I decided not to talk about it because I felt I didn't understand it well enough, or I felt comfortable discussing it and you know, unavoidably taking a position on it until I had wrapped my head around it enough.
So I don't know in what domains you're sort of actively seeking out and open-mindedly considering new evidence. If those domains are mainly about skepticism mm-hmm. and science and medicine and the things that you like, you have a lot of practice thinking well about those things, then I think it's probably correct not to expect there to be radical shifts mm-hmm. Because you're like in your element, essentially. When I look at the things that top scientists and top skeptics are, I think, clearly wrong about, of course it's all, you know, relative, but the things that I think they're wrong about, they're mostly not in those people's areas of expertise.
Exactly. Yes.
So, you know, look at the top skeptic heroes. Look at Feynman and Neil deGrasse Tyson. And like, I can see things that I think they're wrong mm-hmm, about. Sure. They're just not in physics, say. Yeah. Like, I think Feynman was wrong about women. I think he was wrong about, like, to what extent women are sort of have the capacity for intelligence mm-hmm. and moral worth. I think Neil is wrong about atheism to some degree. Yeah, we have philosophical disagreements.
Yeah, I mean, so, Neil deGrasse Tyson's a great example of that. He's, again, I think brilliant in anything in astronomy and physics, and, you know, but the farther away you get from that, you know, then obviously the more out of his element he is. So he's commented on, like, alternative medicine in a way that makes the medical skeptics cringe a little bit. And then, but to his credit, you know, when we explained to him, it's like, well, no, that maybe weren't expressing that in a way that really captures the essence of what's really going on. He was open to it and happy to evolve, you know, his thinking about it. All right, Julia, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I enjoyed
this.
Thank you,
Julia.
Thank you, guys. Happy 10-year anniversary.
Thank you so much. We'll see you soon.
Here's to 10 more. Yeah,
absolutely. I want that hat.
Yeah, we'll send the hat.
Save the hat. Yes, the hat.
Got it.
Hey, well, guys, we're going to take a break to talk about the amazing meeting. The amazing meeting, we've been to quite a number of them. They're always a great deal of fun. This year, the meeting is July 16th to 19th at the Tropicana in Las Vegas. The SGU will be there. We're going to be doing all of our usual stuff. We'll have a dinner with an auction Friday night, and we'll be doing, obviously, shows from the stage. We will have our table so we can meet a lot of our listeners. The conference itself is just tremendous fun.
Oh. Yes, so that's one of the highlights of my year. This is the biggest skeptical event of the year. Every year, this year is going to be no different. There's going to be a celebration of James Randi. There's conference sessions, workshops and panels, $1 million paranormal challenge.
Among the people that will be appearing, of course, there is forever James Randi, as he is a fixture at these meetings. It is going to be emceed by George Harab, whom you're all familiar with. But look at some of these names of some of these other speakers. I mean, these are people that we're very familiar with. Dean Cameron will be there again this year. Timothy Caulfield, whom we just interviewed recently, is going to be there. Brian Deere, his work against Tim Wakefield, he's also going to be making an appearance. And I believe for the first time ever, our dear friend, Dr. Dean Adele will be at this year's TAM. That is awesome.
He's awesome. And some old favorites like Bruce Hood, Ray Hyman, Jamie Ann Swiss, Massimo Pellucci, Massimo Polidoro. You get two Massimos.
For the price of one.
What's better than that? Todd Robbins. I can keep going. It's going to be great.
So many others. So go to their website, www.amazingmeeting.com, for all your information regarding this year's TAM.
All right, guys, let's get back to our show.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Guys, I'm dying to do this. I want to do my science or fiction.
Oh, yeah?
Okay, let's do it.
Can we do it? All right, so Steve asked all of us to do science or fiction. I said, okay, I can't do science or fiction as good as Steve, so I came up with science fiction. So this is my twist science on fiction, science or fiction. I'm going to give you six pieces of information about the movie Star Wars. One of them is false.
Six.
Yeah, this is more about just talking about interesting things that I researched about the movie. All right. Five of these are true. The first one, the sound of a TIE fighter engine is actually an elephant call mixed with other sounds. Item number two, most actors cast as stormtroopers needed to be left-handed due to the design of their E-11 blaster rifle. Item number three, Luke Skywalker and his relatives were originally imagined as dwarves in early drafts. Item number four, George Lucas originally planned for Yoda to be played by an adorable monkey wearing a mask and carrying a cane. Item number five, R2-D2 is named after a piece of film editor's jargon. It means real two, dialogue two. And the last one, six, during filming of Empire, the actors had a fake script that read, Luke, you are your own father. All right, Evan, go first. Which one is not true?
Luke Skywalker and his relatives were originally imagined as dwarves in early drafts. Well, how's that? Really? I mean, how could that possibly be? Because Lucas knew what the big picture story was here. He didn't, all of a sudden, Darth Vader, Anakin Skywalker and Padme gave birth to a dwarf? What? So that's a disconnect for me. I think that one, number three, Luke Skywalker originally imagined as dwarves? No. Fiction.
Okay. Bob?
Yeah. Some of these, it seemed like a no-brainer, like, oh yeah, that's ridiculous. That can't possibly be true. But then I remember we're talking about Lucas here. So all bets are off. Nothing surprises me.
That's why this is perfect.
Right? That's why it's perfect. Especially when you say early draft, because I've heard of some of his early ideas, and I don't know how much of that is apocryphal, but some of his early ideas were so wacky, and it took people outside, you know, not him, to say, whoa, let's change this and reel this in. And that's why, you know, those early movies were so good, is because he didn't have free reign like he had in the prequels, all right?
Well, it makes sense as he's developing a new movie that he had tons of ideas, right?
So,
episode one,
a lot of these, the two that make the least sense, all right, left-handed blaster rifle. I could see that. They made a design that's kind of like needs to be done by somebody with a left hand. I can kind of see that. But the dwarf one is killing me. And the monkey, the monkey playing Yoda. I can't see either of those. Unless Yoda had such a minimal part that it could have conceivably been played by a monkey wearing a mask and carrying a cane. But even that, I'm just not buying. So it's between those two. Everything else is somewhat more feasible. I guess the dwarf one, I guess I'll go with that one, because, I mean, how could you have a hero? I mean, I don't think he would imagine it, you know, that way.
Okay. All right, you know? Steve?
Yeah, the TIE Fighter one, they used all kinds of crazy sounds, so that's very believable. I don't remember specifically the elephant, but sure. I don't like the left-handed one. That just seems, that seems the silliest to me, actually.
Silly est, E-S-T?
Yeah, I think that, I believe that the original or early imagining of this story, I believe dwarves, I believe the monkey with the mask, I think all of that to me,
sure. It's crazy, man.
The R2-D2, sure, that sounds fine. The other, you know, the Luke, you are your own father is cheesy. I could see how that was made up, but, and I don't know how often actors are punked with fake scripts like that, but I'm not crazy about that one, but I think I'll buy that one. But I think that, like, casting troopers as, why don't they just make different, the prop different? That one seems, makes the least sense to me, actually, of all. I'm going to say that the left-handed stormtroopers is the fiction.
All right, very interesting. Okay, so we'll just go through these in order, because, you know, no stakes here. Okay. The sound of a TIE fighter engine is actually an elephant call mixed with the sound of a car driving on wet pavement.
Remember that picture from Yes.
Awesome.
How cool is that? So sound designer Ben Burt was a film sound buff as a child. He recorded and replayed soundtracks of his favorite movies. He actually re-soundtracked movies when he was a kid. That's why that was so epic.
That's
All right, the second one, number two. Look at how they're carrying those weapons, guys.
Are they left-handed?
Well, lefties.
The right hand is forward, the left hand.
Steve was right.
That's the fiction?
The fact is, yes, they did design all of the blasters. You can see that they have the cartridge coming out, the clip cartridge coming out, and when they held them right-handed, it was jutting into their gut. So they were instructed to hold them the other way, which is, but they didn't cast left-handed actors. They just said, hold them in the other hand.
Of course.
And a very interesting piece of trivia. If you watched closely, you'll see sometimes them fumbling with the guns because it was a little awkward for them to hold them backwards.
Right.
Which I found absolutely freaking, because you guys know I'm blasting crazy. But Steve, you totally got it. I'm so proud of you. That's awesome.
Wow.
Luke and his relatives were actually early imaginings that they were going to be dwarves.
Oh God!
Yeah, I know. That was one of Lucas's ideas. Okay, so this fourth one, it's true.
There it is, the monkey.
The filmmaker originally intended to have Yoda played by a monkey. This was revealed in J.W. Rinsler's book, The Making of Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back. The monkey was brought to the set. They trained it to walk with the stick and to wear the mask. Now keep in mind, Empire Strikes Back was made during the late 70s, and there weren't automatronics. They just didn't have it. Mm-hmm. So they were trying to figure out, how are we going to pull this off? What could we possibly do? And this was one of them. Now, the monkey idea seemed pretty promising in the beginning, but a few members of the crew who had it was working. They were training the monkey to wear the mask and to walk with the cane. They were there. They had it going.
Didn't have the vocals down.
Yeah, but not interacting. I mean, how do you interact with a monkey?
They would have had to overdub or do something, Bob. Or maybe going back in and animate. Right. Oh, who knows? But a large chunk of the crew who had worked with that specific monkey on the set of 2001 A Space Odyssey said that they were not sure the monkey would, they thought the monkey was going to keep ripping the mask off because they had worked with this monkey before. And then they scrapped it. And then Lucas contacted the Muppets creator Jim Henson and said, hey, can you help me out here?
And then
when they got Frank Oz.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. George Lucas came up with the name R2-D2 when filming the movie American Graffiti. He didn't actually come up with the name. He heard the name, which I think is so cool. So a member of the sound crew asked him to retrieve reel 2 of the second dialogue track, which in the parlance would be, hey, could you go get R2-D2 for me? George Lucas heard that, said, I love that, made a mental note of it. And I questioned that when I read that, which I thought was so cool. Did he already have Star Wars in his head, or was that like the first ever reference to anything Star Wars that ever existed?
Well, I think he started imagining the movie in the 60s.
So he tucked it away for Star Wars. Okay, that's cool. All right, and finally, the last question. Luke, I am your father. So just check this out. So Lucas was the only person that knew that Darth Vader was Luke Skywalker's father, right? He wrote it. He's like, okay, I don't want anybody on set to know this. I don't want anybody to know. He was the only one who knew. Now think about how lucky he was. The guy that was playing Darth Vader, who was reciting the lines, was wearing a mask.
Yeah, so until they dubbed it in, nobody knew.
Right, so the second person to find out,
Krause was the guy in the
suit. No, it was Darth James,
James Earl Jones.
Jones.
When he read the script.
He read the lines.
He read the lines. So the guy that was acting out Darth Vader.
With that cheesy voice.
Said, Luke, you are your own father. So then he had to tell the crew. He was this. So then Lucas had to weave this ridiculous story of time travel, and Luke goes back in time and is his own father.
It was all bullshit.
And the crew was pissed. The actors were pissed because they knew it sucked. They were like, oh my God, that's what's going on? How stupid. So that was really cool. So then they didn't know it until they saw it in the movie theater. How cool is that?
Oh my
I love
God.
That.
Wait, but how about when Luke is injured and on the ship at the end and he calls out, Father, how did that?
Well, that must have shot that after. That's right.
Talking to himself.
Even more profound, when Luke says, no, right?
He was reacting
to the bullshit line, not the real line.
Yeah.
Which means that the director, who was awesome, I'm sure the director knew.
That's impossible. Wait. That line makes sense.
Yes.
That's impossible.
Oh my God, Steve, I didn't even think about that. I wonder though, do you think Lucas shared the truth with who was the director of Empire? I forgot his name.
Erwin Kirshner.
Do you think Kirshner knew? I bet you he did. He had to tell him. I don't know. I just don't know.
We don't know.
If I wish someone
would. All right, that was fun.
Very good director.
And I did find out one other cool piece of trivia I just want to share with you guys. In the Revenge of the Sith movies, how many actors actually played a cloned trooper? Real quick, just throw out the answer.
I'm sorry, which one? Revenge?
What?
One.
There were thousands of clone troopers in the movie. How many people actually, real actors, played a clone trooper?
Oh, I got you. Of like 15, 20?
12, zero.
Oh, they're all CG.
100% CG.
Yeah.
That's the way of things now.
Other than the guy who played
Other than the main actor. Yeah. I mean, every single other one was all CG.
Other than Django.
Richard, do you want to play science or fiction with us?
Last time I won.
Yes.
Okay, here we go. So these are three items. These are pseudosciences. Two of these are real pseudosciences, and one is a pseudoscience I made up.
Okay.
Got it? All right. So the first one, the Bates Vision Correction System claims to correct vision by staring in particular compass directions, aligning the eyes with the Earth's magnetic field.
Oh, God. Right.
Okay, number two, Dr. Randall Mills claims that he has a process to make hydrogen atoms shrink into hydrinos, providing a source of free energy.
It makes sense.
And item number three, the new chronology claims that events attributed to ancient Greek, Roman, and Egyptian culture actually occurred in the Middle Ages, and that recorded human history began around 800 AD. So which one of those is the fake pseudoscience?
So which one is the fake fake?
The fake fake.
They all sound pretty loopy. I mean, they could easily be. You could have made up all three of them as far as I'm concerned. And without Googling anything, I'm going to opt for the second one, the atoms, the hydrogen atoms.
The hydrinos.
I can see people trying to sell the first one because they sell all sorts of useless therapies to people. And I can see people buying the last one because there's a lot of people out there who – you know, simply confused about the age of history and things like that. So I'm going to opt for number two.
The hydrinos. Okay, Bob, the vision, hydrinos, or the new chronology? Which one
can
is
I see
the fake
look
fiction?
At them again?
Come on, please.
Come on. This is totally not fair because...
Wait, when did fair ever come into this?
Yeah, good point. I mean, because...
The knowledge of pseudoscience. What else is more central to skepticism?
I hear you. Hydrinos fiction.
I'll pick hydrinos too, because if you take a hydrogen atom and shrink it, you're starting with hydrogen. It's not free energy. I'd pick that one.
Okay.
I'll say the magnetic field. Aligning eyes with the Earth's magnetic field. How would you even do? How are they going to know?
Compass directions.
By compass direction.
North, south, east, west?
No. No.
Okay.
Wrong.
So you all agree that the new chronology claims that events attributed to ancient Greek, Roman, and Egyptian culture actually occurred in the Middle Ages, and that recorded human history began around 800 AD. You all think that one is a real pseudoscience.
Yes.
A real pseudoscience.
And that one is real. That's a real pseudoscience.
Ridiculous.
Yep.
Isn't it? I mean,
recorded human history began around.
I would imagine they do that because they don't want things to be older than what the Bible says.
No, it's not. I don't. This is just a alternate history.
Okay.
You know, it's there's a number of people who promote it, but it's I mean, scholars think it's totally full of shit because it is. No, I mean, you have to like completely toss out all of our carbon dating and. Essentially says like this is a massive sort of conspiracy almost, you know, to fabricate this history. Yeah, imagine everything is about 1,000, nothing's older than about 1,000 years old.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine. Okay. We'll go back to number one.
It's going to be the compass.
I'm wrong. Debates vision correction systems, claims to correct vision by staring in particular compass directions, aligning the eyes with the Earth's magnetic field. Evan, you think this one is the fake.
Fake.
The rest of you think this one is the real fake. And this one is the fake.
Fake.
Evan, congratulations.
Oh, damn.
I'm doing so bad this year.
It makes sense because the other ones you can kind of hide in the depths of history for the third one. You know, the atoms, who knows what's happening.
Are you trying to argue that the other ones are more or less ridiculous than this one?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Because, in hindsight.
No. If you listen before you even ridiculous. Said anything, I changed my mind, but I know it was too late. My point is that the two and three, you can hide because it's an atom. It's history. But the compass direction and fixing your vision is more blatant. It's more obvious.
But you're wrong because the Bates vision correction system is a real pseudoscience. It's just complete based on something else.
You said fake.
Yeah, no, but it's not magnetic field. That's the part that I made up.
Okay.
My point is that there are fake systems of fixing your eyes by doing crazy shit. Okay. You know, like staring into the sun. Did you realize that there's a staring into the sun? Because it gives you the life energy or whatever. Or colored lenses is very common, or prisms. There's all kinds of crazy stuff associated with it. Just not the magnetic field, so I made that one up.
Yeah, that's obviously crazy.
All right, but Dr. Randall Mills claims that he has a process to make hydrogen atoms shrink into hydrinos, providing a source of free energy. That is a real fake. That's a real pseudoscience.
Hydrinos, huh?
Hydrinos, free energy from hydrinos.
You made that term up as well.
Because you have the ground state, and then the hydrinos are below the ground state.
Below the ground state.
You can get energy out of it.
Shrinking a hydrogen atom.
What are you shrinking?
What are you shrinking? That was a lot of fun. I mean, you know.
No, it wasn't. My science fiction
was the best one yet this year.
My science fiction was the best.
I'm enjoying looking at the Twitter stream. Our friends from Hungary are laughing at that real pseudoscience.
I hope you enjoyed this show. This was a few segments from our 10-hour, 10-year anniversary live streaming show. Obviously, there's a lot more content that didn't make it into this highlights reel. We will be releasing videos of segments of the 10-hour show on YouTube, so keep an eye out for that. That's in post-production right now. I would like to thank everyone who helped us put together the 10-hour show. It was quite a production. Phil Hudson ran our cameras and controlled the stream during the show. Hans Liebert was our audio engineer. Dennis Mirochnik was our technical advisor and helped us get everything working, actually. Couldn't have pulled off the show without him. Joel Bellucci did the animation for the video introduction and also was a production assistant on the day of the show. George Traub did the music for the video introduction, obviously was one of our in-studio guests. Our brother Joe Novella helped build a lot of this set. Todd and Liz were also production assistants on the day of the show. And Kate Christian did some graphic work for us, including the 10-year anniversary posters that were part of the set. So thanks to everyone. Thanks to all of the guests. Not everyone obviously made it into this the short version for this podcast, but they will be in the YouTube versions that we'll be putting up. Thanks to all of my fellow rogues, past and present, for all the years of work in putting the SGU together. And thanks, of course, to our listeners for their continued support. Obviously, the show would be nothing without all of our listeners. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.